You are listening to the sassiest podcast in the world. Born in the Nordics, democratizing B2B SaaS knowledge everywhere.
Hi, I'm Daniel.
And I'm Thomas, and we are experienced SaaS professionals that are curious about how other successful SaaS companies go to market, scale, build winning teams, and great products.
Join us on our journey as we speak to SaaS leaders trying to get hold of their secret sauce.
And today's guest is Nathan Letka, the founder and CEO at FounderPath.
Finance is a game where if you're patient and you don't chase AUM growth at all costs like others do in our space, you will outlast them and you will win long term.
Welcome to another episode of the Sassiest Podcast. We hope you are well and thank you for joining us again. And Daniel, how are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Very excited about the conversation we're having today. It's going to be lots of fun to talk with this guy. I think it's fair to say Mr. SaaS. Nobody has interviewed as many people as this guy has in our SaaS space.
And he's also a person that has, I think, meant a lot for us. He keynoted the first Sassiest in Malmö. He's been a part at a digital event, and he will also be back in Malmö here in April and in Amsterdam in October. And, well, we're not going to spill the beans yet. Well, if you have clicked on the episode, you obviously know who it is. But anyway, we mentioned Sassiest in Malmö. It's coming up April 16th and 17th, and it's the ultimate B2B SaaS experience. And what does that really mean, Daniel?
It means a few things, but foremost, it means that when you come to an Sassiest event, you'll be able to experience a couple of things that are unique. One, it's about the sessions and the speakers that are on stage. All the sessions are tactical and hands-on. The best thing that can happen is that you listen to somebody, you'll feel like, holy smokes, I learned something. I'm going to do these five steps that Josh was talking about. I'm going to do these seven things that Anna was instructing us about. And on Monday, I'm starting to deploy it. That is what we want to come across. We don't care if somebody raised a gazillion amount of dollars because that doesn't help you. But we care if somebody had a trick, a playbook, some kind of a checklist that they walk through that you can copy and run with. So that is one thing. The other thing is, let's face it, you know, there's so many experts out there, but are there really so many experts out there? You want to learn from operators, from practitioners, from the people that are actually doing the job that you're doing. So we've emphasized a lot in our community, building this community so you can meet with like-minded, so you can meet and engage with your peers in workshops, in one-to-one meetings. So a lot of the program is built around you having the chance to connect and build meaningful relationship with your peers that you can take with you outside of this event as well. Now, we try to wrap this up in a very nice packaging, like everybody does. You know, there is
not everybody does that.
Like everybody's trying to do it, Thomas, I said, but everybody doesn't deliver on it. So there is a great venue. It's an all-inclusive event, meaning that you get, you know, food, drinks throughout the days. There's a bunch of, you know, entertainment, music, DJs, and so on. You're not going to regret it. There's a reason why we're always sold out, and then this year is going to be no different.
Yeah, and is there any social activities around the conference as well?
I love these leading questions. actually, yes, Thomas, there are social activities. So again, coming back to what I said, we want to emphasize in meaningful connections between peers. One way to do that, we understand sometimes it's a little bit tricky. You know, you might come to an event, you don't know anybody at the event. Therefore, we have on day zero, so April 15th already, when you come in and fly and land in Malmö, you'll have the possibility to join the cruise, which is, you know, I don't want to call it I don't want to call it a cruise and booze, but there's going to be some alcohol there. There's
the
going
canal to be tour. It's going to be a small raft.
Yeah. There's going to be some entertainment on the canal tour, call it whatever you call it, Thomas.
Okay.
There are some workshops. There are, for the athletic ones, the ones that want to, you know, get their competitive juices going, we have our yearly paddle tournament. And then, of course, how can you forget? And the person that we have on the show today has actually gone and won this darn thing, the Sassiest poker tournament. That's happening. So there's a bunch of activities like this that are all there focusing on personal relationships.
Absolutely. And for the early risers, the ones that, you know, a little bit, I wouldn't say envious about, but yeah, it's not going to be me. For early risers, there is a morning run and there is a yoga session. So everyone gets happy and finds something that's suitable for you.
Absolutely, Thomas. And with that said, I think we're ready to jump in and welcome the next podcast guest here. And it's fair to say he's been an inspiration for both of us, right? And he's been a good person to spar with and a great friend in the community.
Here we go. Today, we are super excited to have the one and only Nathan Letka here as a guest in the Sassiest podcast. So welcome, Nathan.
Thomas, Daniel, thanks so much for having me.
Man, it only took us 135 episodes to get you on here. Like, you're a tough cookie to get here. I know you're a busy guy. Like, tell us, like, what's cooking on your end right now?
Oh, gosh. I'm just trying to figure out how to help founders keep more equity. So we're doing that at FounderPath. I'm trying to make sure the CEO of GitLatka, Ilya, is well supported by me so he can keep having success over there. We're going deeper on partnerships here at FounderPath, so spending more time with folks like, obviously, Sassiest. So that's what's top of mind for me right now.
All right. But let's take some steps back because there might be people that don't know you, and it would be interesting to hear a little bit from the beginning. Who's Nathan? What's your story?
Oh, man, that's a loaded question. Well, like the quick version of that is born in 1989, so 34 years old today. If we go back to when I was 19, guys, I was freezing. I was on a big open field in the mountains of Southwest Virginia attending Virginia Tech. I was studying architecture, of all things.
Okay.
Did you guys do architecture or something non-related to SAS in college?
Yeah, studied theology.
There you go.
Yeah. No, I'm a business major. That's as thrilling as I am.
That's good. But I mean, I was architecture, and I'll never forget the super glue on my fingertips building balsamic buildings and learning about where the sun's going to hit in the morning on this thing that I designed. But the problem was I overheard fifth-year students when I was a freshman complaining they weren't making enough money. And Virginia Tech was one of the top three programs in the United States for architecture. And I said, I like money too much. I can't be an architect. And that's when I started selling online. I launched a thing called the Fan Page Factory back in the day, which morphed into a company called HEYO.com, Heyo. And what we did is we helped companies drag and drop together Facebook apps, sort of like you would pay Wix or Weebly or these tools today, right? You guys know those tools?
Yeah.
But for Facebook pages. And so I went out, Daniel, Thomas, and I did what I thought you were supposed to do to have like be successful in software. I hired a bunch on the team. So I had like 40 people. You know, I was 21 years old, living in the nicest apartment in Blacksburg, Virginia, which was still pretty crappy, comparatively speaking. You know, it's a town of 40,000 people, I think, without the college. Anyways, what happened after that is I said, okay, well, my team's big. I have a recurring business model. This is amazing. Okay, what's the next thing I have to check off? What's the next milestone to like define, say, oh, you got to raise capital. Let me get a big valuation. So I played that game and we closed a $2 million Series A at 8.5 pre-money, 10.5 post-money. And at this point, I'm going, I've made it.
Right.
I've done it. I'm 22. I've raised money. I've got 40 people on the team. I've got a software company. I've made it.
Yeah.
And then what happened, I forget what exact date that was, but my cap table was just destroyed. I mean, after this, I was down to 38% on a fully diluted basis. The Series A folks owned 20%. They made me hire an adult supervision COO because I was so young, right, in a rural community in Southwest Virginia. And I had to give him 9%, the COO. So it was like 30% dilution.
Mm. Wow.
Like, you guys know how dilution, I mean, that's a lot, right?
And we don't know dilution because we don't do that.
We don't do dilution.
We don't do that now, but we have seen a lot of dilution throughout the years. Let's put it that way.
We have seen it.
Yeah, fast forwarding, it was about 6 months after the Series A round, a company called iContact, a big email marketing company with about $50 million of revenue, reached out and wanted to buy the company. So we got all the way through diligence. It was a $6.5 million all cash offer. But if your audience was paying attention, and if you guys were listening earlier, what did I say my post-money valuation was 6 months prior?
$10 million.
So to the board, what did I decide to do here? Did I sell the company for $6.5 million and pocket $2 million post-tax as a 21-year-old or not?
You probably wanted to do that, but some of the other owners probably weren't as excited. So I'm going to say it didn't go through.
I didn't know that a board could block a deal like this.
Yeah.
I mean, I had $2 million ripped from my fingertips at 21 years old. And I'm a conservative guy. Imagine if I just compounded that the rest of my life at 10% year over year, I would be set for life.
Mm, right.
And this was the moment, Daniel, Thomas, and everyone sort of tuning in here on episode, what is it, 140 or 137. I mean, this is when I realized, I said, man, why do people raise VC without thinking about all the optionality you lose?
Right.
You lose optionality when you raise money. A lot of people think you gain it. You lose it. And I think, you know, venture capital dollars, I think, are it's the best marketed money in the world, right? Because the VCs have to find founders to invest in, but they invest in 100 and like two of them are going to make a lot of money, right? Of the 100, right? So less options. And anyways, after that, that's when I really said, man, let me learn from other founders what I did wrong, launched the podcast and sort of went on from there.
Yeah. So what happened? Did you sell your share or what happened with the company that you started?
Yeah. So Heyo.com, I kept going after it was rejected. I was deflated. My two co-founders had already left the company. They took 40% equity themselves. So there was non-operating, just dead equity on the cap table, which felt terrible every morning. But I kept building for 3 years.
Yeah.
But the business stayed flat.
Wow.
And in my head, and maybe you guys listening are thinking this too, you're sticking with a bad idea for too long during the prime years of your life because you don't want to let your angel investors down.
Mm.
Like I stuck with it way too long, right? I should have sold it earlier, got the learnings under my belt, and then gone on to start the next thing because every angel then said, I want to invest in the next thing. So we ended up, you know, full disclosure, we ended up selling at a price that was not near 6.5 million, right? We sold much lower than that, you know, 3 years later. So I lost 3 years of my life. I had 2 million ripped from me at 21 years old, right? Because I lost control of the business.
Yeah.
And I lost 3 years of prime building years of my life, right? From like 21 to 24. So I sold it.
So how much money did you get in the end?
Let me just say this. I made more money from Heyo based off the salaries I paid myself over the years operating it than I did at the exit. Just put it that way.
Cool.
Is that fair?
That's fair.
I'm liking this. Like I feel Thomas is like, he puts on his Nathan Latke interview hat today. Like I'm liking it.
They're I mean, we do the Nathan Light thing in the beginning of the episodes, asking some numbers and so on. But as you
what
mentioned-
What is Nathan Light? Like you can drink it with no calories or what?
Yeah, something like that. So you mentioned you started the podcast. Was that basically the next thing you did? And why did you start the podcast in the first place?
Yeah, so I asked my angel investors after I sold Heyo, guys, look, you saw me operate for 4 or 5 years here, very young. It was my first company. What do you think I was really good at? What should I spend more time on? And they all said, Nathan, we've never seen somebody close as many customers on webinars as you do. You should do something in media.
Mm.
And I said, okay, well, what's the quickest and cheapest thing to launch in media? And it was podcasts.
Yeah,
right.
Right. So I launched the podcast and I said, okay, I don't want to do podcasts the rest of my life. But let me do podcasts in a space that I know I'm going to build a product for at some point in the future. So I'll build my distribution channel first. That is when in August of either 2016, 2017 is when I launched the podcast.
And you have done how many episodes so far?
We just passed 3,376.
Oh, that's crazy. But what can you tell us about episode one? What was episode one in the podcast?
Oh my gosh, this is terrible. Well, my like vision wasn't as clear for the podcast on the early days. So I actually think the first interview was with an internet marketer who had built a big list. Her name was Kim and her last name is escaping me. She has blonde hair, big personality. I met through socialmediaexaminer.com actually.
Okay.
And then I quickly sort of got away from that space once I realized I just really love software. And for 3,000 plus interviews, it's been a B2B SaaS CEO every morning for 20 minututes.
So I have a question here and like, maybe because my mind and head is not right with me. You said over 3,000 episodes in less than 10 years. That's like, you know, over 300 episodes a year. That's one podcast recording a day. Like, what's the catch here? What am I missing in my calculation? That's a lot of episodes.
Yeah, I don't actually wake up every morning and say, who am I interviewing today? I record 2 days a month max. And on each day, I'll do between 15 and 20 interviews. So some months I'll record 37 interviews. Some months I'll go a little under because people cancel the meeting and I'll do maybe 26 interviews. But like net, it comes out to about one per day.
Okay, so do you have a team that sort of serves all of this to you? So you just need to sit down and do it and everything, you know, guest by guest by guest is coming to you? Or how does it work? Like speed dial.
Mm-hmm. When I started off early on, I did hours of prep work before every call. I drove to a local podcast studio I was renting for $100 an hour, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, there was even one time where I did like hair and makeup before the podcast. I mean, there was a lot. Yeah. I mean, I was like, just to be clear for your audience, this is all natural. This is Nathan Light happening right now.
looking sharp.
Thank you. But what I realized is the number, if I asked you guys, what's the number one reason podcasts fail? What would you say?
I would say you don't do enough episodes and you're not publishing them regularly. Mm-hmm. Am I wrong?
What I saw from a lot of my friends is whatever cadence they established for their shows, you know, Tuesday, Thursday, you know, twice per week or once per day or once per month, once they establish that cadence with their audience, then you're building a habit loop. They come back and they expect the next thing.
Yeah.
If you don't deliver on that, it breaks the loop and you lose audience.
Yeah.
The number one reason podcasts fail generally is not because the content is bad or anything like that. It's because the hosts lose the focus and energy and dedication and consistency to keep it up for a long period of time. The largest podcasts today measured by number of downloads are the ones generally speaking that have been around the longest, the most consistent.
Yeah.
Right. So what I did is I said, Nathan, I'm going to quit podcasting if I have to go to a studio every day and wait for my hair and makeup to be done and wait for like all the perfect things to align. And if I have to study every guest for 3 hours before they come on, I can't do one per day.
No, exactly.
So I cut all that away. And that's how we got it to where it is today.
Yeah. So, I mean, you're well known for your sharpshooting and getting all the numbers and, you know, all of that. When did you start doing that?
Here's another thing I learned listening to other folks' shows. There's a lot of really smart people in the world, smarter certainly than I am on a variety of topics. And they would say, well, why does Nathan's show have 20 million downloads, but I'm much smarter than him at SaaS? Right. And this happens in every industry, right? There are people that you guys know, you're listening, that you know you are smarter than. You have more data, you've got better views, you've been in it longer, whatever. You're smarter than them, but their audience is bigger. Why? Because they're focused on entertainment first, because you have to entertain to earn the right to educate.
Yeah.
Right.
What I was doing was a lot of education, but the audience was slipping away. I was only getting like, you know, 50% of each podcast listened to. So what I realized very quickly is I've got to drum up the entertainment value on these shows if I want to earn the ability to coach more founders. And that's when, Thomas, I got even more aggressive on question asking.
Right.
That's what drove that intensity.
Yeah, because we know that you sort of store this figure, you do content with it, and you have by paywalls, so you have to sign up in order to get access to all this data that you gather. But was it first just entertainment, or did you have this idea from the beginning that this could be a product also, or this could be something that I could develop even further?
No, I think some of the best builders in the world would say they develop unique sort of assets, whether it's a content asset or something else. And then they do it all in the same space. And then when they look back 5 years, you know, they go forward 5 years and look back, they all seem to sort of connect some way. I didn't know ahead of time that I was going to build getlatka.com and allow you to search each podcast. That happened because I had people reaching out going, I don't have time to listen to 3,000 episodes. Can I just search for companies that you've interviewed with more than 10 million of revenue that are bootstrapped, that are growing 30% year over year? And I'm like, oh, I got to build a database for this.
So, Nathan, a couple of things here that I really wanted to ask you. One is, what was the initial secret to get the founders to actually speak so openly about the numbers? Because we know that historically, at least, many of them have been a little bit, you know, hush-hush. They don't want to share, at least not publicly. How did you get them to share their numbers, you know, in this open forum like this?
I don't necessarily know that I have a good answer for that, right? What I do know is that a busy founder making time to come on a podcast wants something from the podcast. So I try and think about, well, what do they get out of this? What do they want? And usually it's more views, more listens. They want people to listen and then go check out their website and sign up for their company. Or maybe they're about to go through an M&A process and they know a lot of buyers listen to my show. I mean, there's been dozens of founders that have come on my show specifically because they're in a process and they want to create competition.
Yeah.
There's other founders that come on my show that really want the numbers to be out there because new potential employees that they're recruiting, they want those employees to see that interview.
Yeah.
Right. So I have to figure out like why they're coming on the show. And usually if I can't identify why, it makes it really hard to get the numbers out. I'll obviously try just using charm and stuff. That doesn't always work.
Yeah, and tempo, and you know, driving it, and then I mean, when you get the audience, when you get the entertainment value, people coming on the show, they know what to expect. So probably you can ask questions that they wouldn't answer anywhere else.
They know what to expect, which means the most entertaining thing to do is pattern interrupt.
Okay.
All right. So if people know I'm going to ask ARPU within the first minute, and then wait 5 minutes and then ask customer count, and the audience knows I'm then going to do the math and try and put the CEO on the spot, that's good. Like, that creates a habit. That's why they listen. But sometimes my audience will feel like I'm being too tough on the founder. And so they'll root for the founder to sort of win the episode. If they feel like the founder is full of shit, you know, it's a big VC-backed CEO that says we're the biggest and we're the greatest and we're crushing everybody else and they're not sharing numbers, they'll be rooting for me to win.
Right.
The trick is, it doesn't matter if they're rooting for you or against you, you just want them to pick a side. That's what's going to make them watch the whole show.
Yeah.
Right.
So another question. I mean, we know starting a podcast, it's not a big like moneymaker from the start. So when did you be able to make a living, or when did you start making money on this initiative?
At the end of our first year, I closed HostGator, who paid $120,000 to sponsor the podcast. That was the first sponsorship.
Per year, or?
It was I'm going off memory here, I think 1 60-second mid-roll per week. So they bought 52 placements.
All right.
Right. Now, if you calculate the math, 52 placements into the 120, right, you can back into a cost per placement. It was in the thousands. Relative to my audience size, if I priced my show on a CPM basis, it would sound extremely expensive. But when I showed proof of when I would have like a SaaS founder on my show who's also an author,
yeah,
and I showed how many books we sold quantified by how high up the Amazon rankings they went after the show released, I started to try and figure out how to sell by communicating the influence the show had.
Yeah.
And then sponsors paid for that influence, not on a CPM basis. And so to anyone trying to host their own show, whether you're a software company trying to build a media asset as a podcast, or you guys as a conference group, right, building the community, you want to as quickly as possible try and quantify influence, not number of downloads. And that's where you're going to see your sponsor revenue really go through the roof.
Yeah, that might be a conversation we can have when you come to SaaSiest in Malmo. We can buy a drink or so, and you can tell us how to do that.
I would love that. I would say I have evolved my position on this over the years. I liked making that money early on. Today, I use all of our placements to sell my own products, yeah, right? So FounderPath, $150 million debt fund, GitLatka, the book, other things.
So right now, I mean, fast forwarding, you still have many businesses around this. So how big are these different chunks, and roughly how much do you, what revenue do you have around those? For instance, start with GitLatka. How big an operation is that?
So GitLatka, first off, when FounderPath started taking off, I couldn't do both, right? So I said, I need to go hire an absolute star for GitLatka. And I think I found the best in the world with Ilya Simon. He built his company Datanize to 5 million, bootstrapped, then sold it to ZoomInfo. He took a year off, and then I recruited him in to be CEO of GitLatka. So he is now running that. The only part of GitLatka that I touch is the top of the funnel. It's the initial podcast interview, and then Ilya runs everything else.
Okay.
So I think we've got maybe, I'm making this up because I actually don't know for sure, but I think we have maybe 3 or 4 contractors over there in addition to Ilya. So call it a 3 or 4 person team. That business does plus or minus $1 million a year of revenue. Right, plus or minus $1 million a year.
All right, and what's the different products? It's the website, you have some kind of newspaper, you have some kind of magazine. Is there other things as well?
The way I think about how to make more money at a company like GitLatka is I take my one unit of input, which is 20 minutes of my time to do the podcast interview, and I think, how many ways can I cut it, slice it, and dice it? Right?
Yeah.
Against that one unit of my time, because I need my time to scale. And so we make money by people paying $97 per month for GitLatka, the database, which you can search 35,000 software companies, their profitability, all that stuff, revenue growth.
Okay.
We also then sell the magazine for $300 a year. So we have hundreds or maybe thousands at this point subscribers on that. And these things all add together.
Yeah. And how many customers do you have on the website or that subscribe to your service there?
This is terrible. I don't know the answer to that, actually. I just know total top line revenue is in the millions per year, plus or minus $1 million per year.
Okay. And I mean, Nathan, I know that you do a lot of stuff. We're going to go into that with the FounderPath, with SaaS Open and so on. But GitLatka, is that in the past, or what's the future for GitLatka?
GitLatka will be a very successful media brand for decades and decades to come. It's running, it's growing, it's a great brand. I'll never sell it.
Fair enough.
Hey there, are you back on the growth trajectory again?
congratulations. Then you should connect with Noble Recruitment to hire the best GTM talent for your business. Whether you're looking for a strategic leadership hire, building a whole sales team, or opening a new market, their world-class recruitment teams in Sweden, Denmark, Benelux, UK, and Germany are there to assist. Head on over to noblerecruitment.com and accelerate your recruitment activities starting today. All right, so fast forward till today. Obviously, you're running Founders Path. We know you guys are doing really well. You've built your own community. You have your own SaaS conferences. I know SaaS Open is coming up fairly soon here now. Like, how did this all come about, all these initiatives? And are they in any way intertwined, or you're just good at seizing opportunities and they just happen to come your way?
Yeah, I mean, let me just start by saying, you say Founder Path is doing very well. Founder Path is a very, very, very hard business. It's low margin. We've got, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars of balance sheet risk, right? You've got hundreds of founders that have to make on-time payments every month. We're managing tens of thousands of data points and hundreds of millions of rows of data in our database to make sure everyone stays compliant. It's a very hard business to build. And then you have to make sure that there's spread built in, right? We raise money at a cost of capital. We have to put it out at a higher cost. So, I mean, and then you have to look at charge-offs. I mean, it is a very difficult business to build. Now, I do think we are uniquely positioned to do well because I am an operator. I came from running and building my own software company, right?
Right.
And I think we didn't mention what it was. It's a revenue-based funding company. You loan money to founders so they can keep a bigger piece of the equity in their companies, right?
Yeah, you nailed it. And I pulled this up for you guys actually, right? So again, the book did very well, Washington Journal bestseller, and you see here on page 243, that was the iContact acquisition offer.
Right.
Right. And you can see the highlighted part down there for $6.5 million that got ripped out of my hands, right? So when that happened to me, what I realized is I've got to figure out a way to help founders keep equity. And what I, one of the things that I saw was that it was way easier to build a $5 million bootstrapped company than it was to go try and build a $100 million VC-backed one where you still make money on the end, right? You get to a good liquidity outcome.
Right.
You know, options go underwater, boards kick founders out. There's no buyers because you've raised so much capital, right? You can't get a secondary done for a decade. I just, as my interviews on the podcast went on, it was very clear the happiest founders were the bootstrapped ones with $5 million of revenue that owned 100% that were profiting $1 million per year.
Right. So coming back to what you said, like I have full respect. It is a tough business. You know, like there's so many moving parts here. Like you need to make sure that you raise capital at a rate and then you work with the spread. You know, the money you make is a difference between the money you raise at a certain interest rate with the money that you could put out there and deploy. But you still decided to do it. Is it just the pure passion for being, you know, helpful out there? Because I'm imagining the spread is still probably 6-8% that you make on anybody that can pay their loans back.
Yeah, but there's a lot of things that go into the spread, right? So you have to take into account servicing of the loans. You have to take into account charge-offs. So what if you have a $2 million position that the company goes bankrupt? That's a total loss. That can wipe out all your profits for a year. Right. So what the reason that I really like building Founder Path, right, the fund, right, and you guys, you know, it's a $150 million fund, is it's enough, just like the podcast. Finance is a game where if you're patient and you don't chase AUM growth at all costs like others do in our space, you will outlast them and you will win long term. And so my intention is by 2025 and, you know, going into 2030 is to build the largest asset manager, right, with exposure in terms of alts to B2B software, right? And we are just like Mike Milken did with junk bonds, where he opened up a whole liquidity market for, you know, non-AAA rated companies. We are doing the same thing. Anyone that has not raised VC or doesn't have $100 million of revenue, we've now opened up, right, capital for them. You don't have to go work with a bank anymore. So yeah, it's hard, but I do enjoy it. And I do think Daniel long-term will be able to make a lot of money doing it.
You said that you had fund, and I thought you said fun. But I guess both is okay.
It's actually very hard. When you raise a fund, it's harder to have fun because you have LPs, right? But it is more fun when you have a fund because you can help more founders.
Oh, makes sense.
So how much money have you guys deployed till date?
So life to date, we've deployed about $142 million of capital.
Okay. And is there a particular clientele that is your ICP? Like, you know, Do you have a certain ARR level to in order to even be, you know, part of the discussion?
Yeah, the perfect kind of deal we're doing, and we've done this many times, is call it $1 million or a $2 million term loan into a bootstrapped or capital light B2B software company doing between $1 and $10 million of revenue.
All right. But I think what a lot of listeners would like to understand is, like, you know, how much will this loan actually cost them? Like, what does it take for them to raise this money?
Yep. Well, most founders listening right now, if they've tried to go raise from a bank will want to see either a sponsor, so an equity backer that's put in $10 million, like one of your, you know, Ox, right? A great VC, or they're going to want to see EBITDA, profits. Well, most software companies don't have profits because they're investing in CAC, right? To get growth. So they're never profitable, but they're growing. So who helps in between? And remember, I understand this because I ran a software company, right? And sold it. So we sort of fit in that gap. And so someone listening right now with $5 million of revenue, we could give you a $2 million term loan at as low as a 16% interest rate, and you're going to pay it back over as long as 48 months. It's our longest period. We also will do up to 12 to 24 month interest only period. So you have a lot of time to invest that $2 million of principal to grow your ARR.
Right. I mean, 16% interest is, like, still, you know, it's not very cheap. Like, what are the alternatives? Like, you know, and maybe you have to sacrifice some other pieces, but if I want to have a lower interest rate, it sounds like maybe there are options.
Well, you can get cheaper money if you go raise 10, 20 million of VC and go get bank money at like 9 or 10%,
right?
But the bank's going to have covenants. They're going to want you to bank with that platform. They're going to have a deposit account control agreement on your cash, right? So there's a variety of things. I mean, I think Nick Mehta, speaking at Sastius, Gainsight just raised $47 million at a 12% interest rate from Goldman,
right?
And Gainsight has raised $156 million of equity with over $150 million of revenue. And they've been in business for 15 years and they're still paying 12% cost of capital to Goldman. And that's before origination fees and exit fees.
Right.
You know, Cart.com just raised $24 million from TriplePoint at 15.75% interest. By the way, guys, I'm quoting all these because these are in the 10Qs of all the publicly traded BDCs that invest debt into software companies. So this is all public data. So it's actually, Daniel, this money is fairly cheap for a software company where there's no house to take over if the company defaults.
Right.
It's a lot of numbers here, and I'm not the financial guy, but you also do events, and that is something that I'm very excited about. So what can you tell us about SaaS Open?
Yeah, SaaS Open for us is this idea that I think is important for any software founder in 2024, which is you want to own and operate your own distribution channels.
And you bought this one, right? This was a conference that already existed.
We call this like a small community group. Nobody really knew about it up in New York. We love the name.
Okay.
Open means like open data, right? We require all of our speakers to share revenue on stage. So it makes a lot of sense, SaaS Open.
Okay.
It also expands nicely into other verticals, right? If we want to go into e-commerce or AI, you can just do AI Open or e-com Open or whatever, right?
Okay. Do you own those domains?
We own a lot of domains. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
But we may never use them. We'll see.
All right.
Point being, though, is we put like our borrowers on stage and they get customers. So we're helping them.
Yeah.
You know, we have over 35 CEOs coming with more than $100 million of revenue.
Mm.
I don't know of many other conferences that have such a dense group of sort of revenue in one spot. So there's not a lot of sales reps. We, you know, it's not there to just sort of like drink afterwards with a bunch of AEs. We're trying to sort of create that kind of environment.
Okay.
And tickets are expensive, right? I mean, we make money and we broke even last year, but our goal is to have this be a profitable distribution channel for us. I mean, tickets people paid last year, $2,997 for tickets.
Wow. Yeah, we have something to learn there. I know that you're good at charging at your event and also create, you know, more value also for the ones that are willing to pay that extra dollar.
I wouldn't say more. I would say different value. I think you guys do a fantastic job. Everyone has a different part. You know, we know another friend in the space who likes to really put a lot of VCs on stage, right? And, you know, he does a great job of that, right? It's just not what we want to do.
Yeah. Mm. I mean, I think that's congratulations to you and your team because you guys have done this in such a short time, built up a separate, call it, you know, event platform, a new forum now I'm speaking as an outsider, like in a crowded space already in the US. You know, there's so many actors, so many activities, and, you know, quite a few of them are pretty good at this. So, like, I'm impressed about how you guys have managed to set this up so quickly. One question I had for you, and we hear this from our community as well, like a lot of SaaS companies, they want to run their own events. They want to be these thought leaders, bring people together. But a challenge that they sometimes bump into is that, you know, people are a little bit worried about, like, I'd like to go to company X's conference, but I'm worried they're going to treat me as a lead and then they're going to start bombarding me with emails and messages and so on. How do you avoid finding yourself in that situation, you know, so this is not just another lead list into FounderPath?
Yeah, well, first off, the conference used to be called FounderConf, and it was branded as FounderPath, and we got this feedback. People didn't want to come to what it looked like our user conference, which is why we said, let's make it SaaS open. It's green. It has nothing to do with FounderPath, right? We even have our competitors come speak on stage, right? Other revenue and debt providers are coming, right?
Right.
So it really is sort of Switzerland in that regard. I think that's important. What I would also say is we've created, if you go to saasopen.com and click on setup meetings at the top, we're going to have hundreds of brainstorms. We have 80 tables with 4 to 6 seats each, and anyone coming can teach 6 other people whatever they want.
Okay.
Right. So we don't let people buy the lists of these sort of CEOs anymore. What we do is say, come give great value at your table and we'll curate it with 6 folks that we think might buy from you if you blow them away. And that's how we're doing it.
Wow.
Okay.
Really cool. So tell us a little bit about, obviously you come across lots of great SaaS company, some up and comers and so on. Are there any key trends that you've seen? And again, coming back to distribution channels, is there anything that you feel like this is where all SaaS leaders need to double down to be successful in 2024 and going forward?
Well, I mean, look, there's only one way to grow a software company. Get more customers and get your current customers to pay more, right? It's cheaper to get current customers to pay more, right? So start there. And then to get new customers, you want CAC arbitrage. Like, I don't care if your LTV to CAC is 5 to 1. If it takes you 3 years to get your money back, who cares? I want people to get their money back on day one. Sell something at the top of the funnel. So like, that's how you create optionality. My whole goal is I want to reverse engineer when the founder sells for $100 million. How can we make sure the founder still owns 70% of the business? That's what I'm trying to, I want to make a bunch of millionaires, right? And so you have to get founders thinking about this stuff early on if they're going to have a lot of equity at exit.
Yeah.
So are there any like companies you want to like point to that specifically you feel like, man, these guys have done it really well? They're really efficient with their existing customer base, you know, selling more to them, increasing prices, but they're also really good at acquiring customers at a relatively low cost.
Yeah, I mean, one of the ones that's really impressed me is ClickUp, because they had competitors in the space already, Monday.com. They compete with Atlassian as well. But ClickUp and Zeb, I mean, they have been extremely creative. I mean, if you go and look them up on Ahrefs and look at their site structure, you'll see they're testing all kinds of stuff. Compare pages, programmatic SEO, live events, conferences, curated events on a yacht with 25 folks, right? Curated dinners, Zeb having his own show on YouTube. I mean, they are testing so many things, and then they kill stuff that doesn't work and double down on what's working very quickly. So they've really impressed me. And, you know, ClickUp is now over $150 million of ARR, just, you know, being relatively young.
Yeah. And ClickUp will actually be at SaaSiest to talk a little bit about SaaS influencers and how they've leveraged that to acquire customers. So like, we'll continue this topic in April again.
Yeah, that's great.
Sounds good.
And Nathan, it's so impressive to hear about what you have done these years. And I must ask you, I mean, you're still young, much younger than we are. So you have the future in front of you. So is there an end game here? Where do you want to go? I mean, 10, 20, 30 years in the future?
Yeah, I'm really fortunate to have sort of set up a thing with FounderPath that I can see myself doing for a very long period of time. I mean, think about it. I get to work with founders. I sit on a lot of data. I mean, I don't know anyone else that sits on as much. I mean, we're connected real time to thousands of software bank accounts. When founders connect to us and we underwrite them, we sit on that. We sit on almost $10 billion of transaction volume across SaaS businesses.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's the perfect thing for me to be building. And I'm just fortunate that I found myself here at 34 so I can focus on compounding for the next 60 years.
Yeah. So it's not that you're looking for a really big exit and then you're going to buy that island and I don't know, go big fishing or something like that.
Look, we have competitors like Pipe that tried to play that game, which is juice up the cow, get AUM high and exit. And those founders are now no longer at that company.
Yeah.
You cannot play short-term games in a fintech space where you are asset heavy on your balance sheet. You will have charge-offs and you will get destroyed.
Okay, let's hope you don't get destroyed. And let's hope that you can run this for many, many years. And is there something beyond helping all these, and I think that alone is very honorable, beyond helping all these founders have a bigger stake in their success, like, do you have a dream? I don't know. Are you running for a president?
I would vote for you, Nathan. Definitely. Can't you get into the race? It's terrible this year in the US. So
yeah,
save us.
I unfortunately, the incentive structure behind the political landscape in the US is one that does not incentivize sort of practical, creative folks to throw their hat in the ring. Otherwise, you'd see folks like Mark Cuban running. So we'll see what happens. You know, I won't obviously rule anything out, but we'll see what happens. In the meantime, though, very, very happy building. And look, I mean, Daniel, there's no sort of like change the world thing. Like at my core, I'm a competitor and I work really hard. And every founder is playing their own board game at their company. And if they choose to let me put debt in and join their board game, I love trying to help them move the pieces to the right places so that they can win. And I'm playing hundreds of board games. I mean, I feel like I'm just at a board game convention all day long. So I could do this for a very long time and be very happy.
Yeah. Because I have a prediction, if I may here. So you've probably seen the latest news from Carta. They had a little bit, call it a public incident, where they were maybe creating a parallel liquidity market for secondaries and so on. I'm just thinking out loud here now. Like it might be a natural step for what you guys are doing. Like I'm imagining now a massive marketplace for founders that are successful, but that are maybe ready to at some point de-risk a little bit. They could potentially do that via a Nathan Letka-led platform.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of questions there. And I think that's very sort of attentive of you in terms of looking at the data we're sitting on and what we could be doing. You know, if we had a $500 million secondary fund and we offered a founder with $10 million of ARR to buy 20% of their shares at a 3x multiple, but we let them take that all off the table, right? So let's say they had $15 million from us they could take off the table. The problem is FounderPath then has $15 million tied into this company. We have a minority position, so we can't drive a liquidity outcome for us. There's a potential where that founder is so happy with the money we just let them take as a secondary, they run it forever and we never get a liquidity event, especially if they never pay dividends.
Yeah.
So you then have to basically go out and raise that fund from LPs that also share the same time horizon that could be decades. We would have to go raise a fund with committed capital for like 30 years, I think, to run a successful secondary play, unless we did the secondaries and then packaged them up and sold them off to sort of someone else on the back end. But then you sort of lose the direct relationship with the founder. So I like where you're going with that, Daniel, but there's like, I have a whole list of questions on that we have to answer first before we launch anything significant in that space.
Thomas, you heard it here first. The marketplace is happening.
All right. So let's take something easier with not that many questions. And well, I mean, you have interviewed 3,000 people on your podcast. Who do you think we should have next on our show?
Oh, man.
And can you hook us up with someone really exciting?
Yeah. So depending on what your audience finds exciting, I could recommend someone that's super inspirational, right? So like 300 million plus of revenue that would inspire your audience, but won't be practical because they are so far ahead of where most SaaS founders are. Or I can recommend someone that is only two steps ahead of where most your audience is, right? So they're doing 20, 30 million bucks. Revenue.
All right. Take one of each.
On the inspirational side, I would say Jeff Cotton, 330 million bucks of revenue. He's turning around a company called Alvaria, a big SaaS company here in the States.
Okay.
On the actionable side, so only a couple steps ahead of your audience, I'd recommend someone like Lushan, who's running Surfer SEO, bootstrapped to 10 million bucks of revenue, primarily on the back of affiliates. Really smart guy, and he owns 100% equity.
Okay.
All right. We're going to have to chase them down unless you can hook us up, like Thomas said here. So, Nathan, thanks again. Much appreciated for you joining the show here. And we'll do a lot of stuff this year together. So, you'll be with us at Sassiest in Malmö, but also Sassiest in Amsterdam. And who knows, maybe we'll pop in a European city together somewhere soon. Let's see.
Yeah, and maybe we come over to the States and visit your SaaS Open event. We can only hope.
We would love that. We would put you on stage. We'd have you interview founders, and we'd make sure we host a dinner for your CEO group. You guys have done an incredible job building this, and very excited to join your conferences this year. Brand new content only on your guys' stage. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Great. Looking forward to it.
Take care now.
See you guys.
All right, Daniel, what's your takeaway from this episode?
Always when I speak with Nathan, always when we have a conversation with this guy, I feel like I get a slap in the face because it's a little bit of a wake-up call. I always see ourselves and our little organization as, you know, we pride ourselves in how efficient we are, that we do things well, that we do things fast. And then here comes Nathan and that does, you know, over 300 episodes a year, and we're pretty happy about our maybe 100 that we do a year. So, you know, it's always good to hear that you can always improve, and you should find inspiration in people that have found a process around this that make, you know, can do more with less. And I think this is also true for many SaaS companies. And we see in our community that there are some companies that are outperforming sometimes much greater and bigger competitors because they're just more crafty.
they're just like more efficient in what they do. And I think that's what it comes down to. Like you want to scale a business, you just got to be efficient and you got to have the possibility to execute really well. And like every time I speak to Nathan, I feel like, man, this guy beats on us on all of these things. But it's a true inspiration.
Absolutely. Always.
Yeah.
Always.
What about you, Thomas? Like, is there anything else that you feel like, man, I learned something new today?
Well, I'm not going to pretend that I understood or all the figures or so around the revenue-based funding and so on. It goes way too quick for me, at least today when I'm a little bit soggy. But, you know, I like this story and also how we mentioned that, you know, he started asking all these questions. It was entertaining. It gave, you know, some flavor to his episodes. And then people reached out to him and said, okay, how can I consume this in a better way? And that led to him starting the Get Latke initiative. And that led to another thing and another thing. And I think if you really listen to your audience and you sort of try to serve them in a good way, good things can happen. And I think also a lot of the initiatives we have done is by, you know, listening to the community and try to do something that brings value to them. And then it can also be value for you when you create a business.
Definitely. I don't know if you caught up on that when he was talking about in order to educate, you first have to entertain.
Yeah.
I thought that was really clever. And then again, like now it sounds like I have a man crush on him. Maybe I do a little bit. like, but you know, it's brilliant in what he's explaining and how he was talking about, you know, it's him versus the person that he interviews.
Yeah.
And you know, that's really classical storytelling. In every story, there needs to be a villain, there needs to be a hero, and the audience will pick a side. And in this case, nobody has predefined who the villain is and who the hero is.
Yeah.
But I think that's also a lesson that many of our listeners can take, you know, in their storytelling. And everybody is trying to run a community and show and so on. That's one way of creating entertainment, you know, the classical villain and hero exercise.
Yeah. Do we have such a relationship?
We don't have that in our interviews.
Yeah. We don't have that dynamic in our podcast.
No.
Maybe we should.
Like so we play in our podcast on different angles. You know, we try to double down on, you know, we're the nice guys. We're bringing forward the nice people that have something nice to share. So it's a little bit of a feel-good exercise.
Yeah, but also challenge a bit and, you know, ask the questions that we really wonder ourselves, right?
Right.
And sometimes that means, I don't know, being a little bit blunt perhaps, or so, asking some maybe not that convenient questions. I don't know. But it's great fun. Anyway, let's continue with the podcast and hope that we can get some of the recommendations that Nathan gave us here. And another recommendations for you here is to meet up with us during the year. So we are doing local meetups across the Nordics and the Benelux and the Baltics, and keep your eye out after a local meetup near you. And a good way of doing that is to sign up at the newsletter or visit the webpage or follow the LinkedIn page. So make sure that you're up to date with everything Sassiest.
Indeed. All right. I think, again, looking forward to seeing you all. And until next time, stay safe, stay healthy. See you soon.